Local civil rights groups call for a moratorium on pedestrian tickets. Police foil a plot to shoot up the Islamic Center of Northeast Florida. And it's 5 years in federal prison for former Congresswoman Corrine Brown. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we're always live at 9. Also, make sure to get our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and through our app. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. You can get on the line now and join the conversation, 549-2937. Then later, how you can help make the holidays a little brighter this year for local students. Plus, Phase 8 Theater Company rings in the holidays with a little Shakespeare right here in our WJCT studios. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly media roundtable. A very busy news week to discuss as we welcome Ben Konark. He's on the line, a reporter for the Florida Times Union. Hi, Ben.
Hey, how are you?
Good to have you on the show. With us once again this morning, regular contributor Fred Matthews. Hey, Fred.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. And Tim Gibbons is here. He's editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
Guys, so good to have you. And lots to discuss this week, everything from Corrine Brown's sentencing to quick action by police on a foiled plot to target a local mosque and more. Lots of news. But our top story this Friday, local civil rights groups, along with two members of the Jacksonville City Council, are calling for police to suspend all citations of pedestrian traffic tickets in the city. Now, this demand comes on the heels of the Times Union's Walking While Black investigation. The TU and ProPublica recently reported that, according to the data, police in Jacksonville selectively enforce pedestrian infractions like jaywalking, and they overwhelmingly issue tickets to pedestrians in poorer and majority Black neighborhoods. Sheriff Mike Williams appeared before a city council committee Monday, and he sought to reassure lawmakers that Black citizens are not being targeted. Still, local civil rights groups such as the NAACP and the Northside Coalition are asking for a halt to these tickets being issued until there's further investigation. What do you think about this? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. You can also weigh in on our Facebook page. And Ben Konark, let's begin with you. You reported this story along with the national organization ProPublica. Civil rights groups are making this call 2 weeks after you reported that the majority of tickets issued in the city for pedestrian infractions go to African Americans, more than 55%. Can you bring us up to date once again for people who haven't been following this, how you got this information and what the data shows?
Sure. We got the information from the statewide transportation called TCATS. I forget right now what the acronym stands for. But basically, we had to get this data from a statewide standpoint. It was millions and millions of records. And then we drilled into Duval and basically looked at, you know, who's getting the tickets. And we found that 55% of all the tickets in Duval County go to Black people. And when you start to calculate based off zip code of residence, you find that you're almost six times more likely to get a ticket if you live in one of the city's three poorest zip codes, and you're about three times more likely to get a ticket if you are Black in Jacksonville. So that is the basic racial disparity that we uncovered through this data.
You can join the media roundtable. Let us know your thoughts on the follow-up to the TU and ProPublica's Walking While Black investigation. The number to join us, 549-2937. Ben, what about the fact that two members of the city council, Reggie Brown and Garrett Dennis, say they support the idea of suspending the writing of pedestrian tickets until this issue has been fully addressed?
Yeah, so this idea of suspending pedestrian tickets, I guess, came from Ben Frazier, who is with the Northside Coalition, who has been advocating on both matters of policing and matters of infrastructure for some time. So he sees this as a way to kind of halt the process while they figure out with the sheriff, what's leading to this disparity. We as reporters haven't taken any position on potential solutions. We've just done the reporting and asked for responses. And, you know, these responses that we've gotten from the sheriff's office have continued to evolve over time. It now seems like their chosen way of sort of dismissing these disparities is by saying, well, there's only 2,200 pedestrian tickets in 5 years, and we issue this many traffic citations, so it's really, you know, not that big of a deal, which we don't find to be very convincing at all, right? Because if something is happening and it's wrong, it doesn't matter if it's happening once every other day or every day, it should be happening. So that is kind of where we're at right now. We are still in contact with the sheriff's office. We still have questions that are unanswered at this point, but we are working on getting more answers. As for the city councilors, we spoke with Mr. Brown and Mr. Dennis, and we are going to continue to stay in touch with them. We did not, reach out to these city councilors to ask them to do this. We haven't spoken to any other city councilors, so that's kind of where we're at with that. We're kind of watching as observers to the local reaction, but we are not really pushing or supporting it one way or another because we're still focused on reporting.
Okay, and the number to join us, 549-2937. Fred Matthews, this is an example of the kind of investigative reporting that can lead to policy changes, potentially. State Representative Kim Daniels also says she will introduce legislation in Tallahassee that would further regulate the issuing of these types of tickets, specifically that a warning be issued before a citation, because as Ben's reporting has shown, a lot of these tickets were actually issued in error. People were issued tickets and then went to court and fought them, and the judge found that they hadn't broken any laws.
Well, I mean, this just goes to the old case of these are the daily indignities that happen in these particular zip codes. They weren't named, but I'm sure we're talking about 32208 and 09 specifically that get this. But these are kind of daily indignities that people talk about that others don't know about. Imagine how many tickets could be given out in downtown San Augustine of this type, okay? And you wonder, what's the cause? Are we trying to intimidate the neighborhood, the local drug dealers, to get them to get to hook somebody here who can flip on somebody else? I mean, what is the purpose of it? That becomes the key. I'm not surprised that the sheriff probably didn't even know about these statistics, even though he's been on the force for almost 30 years. He probably didn't know about these statistics because it's not something that anybody will worry about, except for the cops that are on the beat that happen to have a burr in their saddle about something and decide they're going to do this. But it is an unnecessary activity, given all the other things that the sheriff's office have to do, and it doesn't require that much legislation at all. It just requires the sheriff and the zone commander. The zone commander, in fact, I met with her earlier this week of 32209, who handles that area. She's new there. But just requires the zone commander and the sergeants that are in charge of the shifts to instruct their people to not do unnecessary arrests and harassments and tickets.
Tim Gibbons.
It's interesting. Your statement of the sheriff probably was not aware of these statistics, which makes perfect sense to me. The idea that this is not a huge number of tickets across the entire city, but has a huge impact on the lives of the people who are getting them. There's a type of thing that we talk about when we talk about relations between some neighborhoods of the city and the police department that it just becomes a constant, everyday, wearing down sort of thing that creates a very distrustful sort of relationship. I can easily believe that there's no quota for the tickets, but that doesn't mean that they're not encouraged to do this because it's how you put a police presence in a neighborhood.
And Ben Konark, as you also reported along with ProPublica, if people cannot afford to pay the ticket, that can have a ripple effect in terms of someone's right. credit rating or even their employment. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can. And before I get there, I want to just jump back to this idea of erroneous citation, because it is, I think, maybe the most disturbing response we've received from the sheriff's office so far. Is they basically have shrugged their shoulders. We just got word from them yesterday, and their party line on this now is that, you know, there's about 350 tickets we identified. They've never asked us what the tickets were. They never asked us, you know, it's published in the project, but they've never been intellectually curious about how we came to that conclusion. We feel very confident that these tickets are invalid. So you're talking about hundreds of tickets that should never have been given in the first place. And the position they've basically taken is well, if you challenge it in court, it's up to the judge. You can challenge it in court, and if a judge tells us we're doing it the wrong way, we'll use that as a training opportunity for our officers. We feel we've already given them enough information to retrain their officers on the statute. We know that they are doing a review at the state attorney's office to look at the statute. We don't know what the status of that review is. We have asked. But it is, to me, disheartening, to say the least, that they would basically shrug their shoulders at this idea that, you know, hundreds of people are getting these tickets and they don't comply with state law.
All right.
To get back to your question, and some of the very on-point comments from the other panelists here, you know, these 2,200 tickets, we feel, are just a slice of the pedestrian interactions that happen. Not everyone gets a ticket. Some people get warnings. Some people get no paperwork at all. And, you know, the tickets, I think, are for certain circumstances. If you talk back, you're probably going to get a ticket. You know, if they find something on you, you're going to get a ticket because they want to make the charges stick. So they need to solidify that probable cause in the record. But there are untold numbers of encounters that happen. So this idea that, well, it's only 2,200 tickets over 5 years is frankly disingenuous. To go back to your question, Melissa, the effects from these tickets are very real. They lead to driver's license suspensions, even if you're 13 years old and you don't have a driver's license yet. If you don't pay it, which most people don't, more than half of the people don't, it will linger in your credit rating. If you get your license suspended and you get pulled over, that's a misdemeanor arrest. If that happens three times, that's a felony. And that's a mandatory minimum of 3 years in jail. So these traffic tickets are real, and they have a very real effect on people's lives.
Let's go to some calls. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. What are your thoughts about the fallout from the Times Union investigation in collaboration with ProPublica, Walking While Black, as civil rights groups and two city council members now call for a moratorium on police issuing these pedestrian tickets? 549-2937. Susan is in Arlington. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks.
I was listening to this on the news the other day, and I heard you again talking about it this morning, and I was just curious about the ratio of African Americans in these zip codes compared to the others, and does that maybe inflate the disparity that's being reported in the count?
Thanks for the question, Susan. Ben Konark, can you address her question?
Sure. Yeah. So we did a countywide analysis, right? So the population of African Americans in Duval County is 29%. So yeah, certain zip codes have more African Americans, and those zip codes are the ones that are getting more tickets. To me, that doesn't inflate anything. I mean, you have to ask why they're ticketing people in the north side and not ticketing people where I live, in Riverside or in Avondale or out of the beaches. So, you know, to say, well, you know, there's more black people living in that zip code that gets more tickets, to me, that kind of proves our point.
Okay. So basically what the data is showing, Ben and Fred and Tim, is that if you jaywalk in Riverside, Avondale, or the beach, or an area that has a majority white population, okay, you're simply less likely to be issued a pedestrian ticket.
I mean, if you remember, I don't know, was it earlier this year that JSO actually cracked down on jaywalking everywhere?
Yeah.
For like a weekend or something. And, you know, the social media outrage of, I'm downtown and I cross the street and I got a ticket, people went nuts because you don't get a ticket for jaywalking. Come on, that's insane. Say people who are in, you know, Riverside and the beaches and areas like that. So, you know, the lived reality of people who are not in those zip codes is, yeah, we don't get ticketed for it. Yeah, come on. If you get ticketed for that, the lived reality of the people in those zip codes is very different.
What's the average cost of the ticket?
It's about $60, isn't it, Ben?
Yeah, it's a $65 ticket.
Whoa.
Okay. All right. John is in St. Augustine. Right. Go ahead, John.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, I'm just wondering why we're not talking about this as a cultural or educational issue versus a black and a white issue. And also, is there any relation between the number of pedestrians hit in these areas versus other areas?
Yeah, and thank you for that question, John, because, Ben, police say, look, this is a dangerous city for pedestrians. We've got to do this to make pedestrians safer, which is certainly a valid concern. But your investigation showed there is no correlation. Is that correct?
Right. So there's a couple things here. Yes, that is indeed it. Jacksonville is the fourth worst city for pedestrian safety in the country. It's consistently ranked in the top five worst cities. It is absolutely a real issue, and the city has hired engineers who study this kind of stuff for a living to help solve that issue. They all come down to the same place, which is that it's an infrastructure solution. It's not something you can ticket your way out of. As far as the relationship between who's getting, we were only able to study who's getting killed, pedestrian fatalities, serious injuries, and light injuries. We just focus on fatalities. So if you look at fatalities, it's actually perfectly in line with the population. About 30% of those getting killed are Black, and about 30% of the people who live here are Black. And if you look at where they're issuing the tickets, right, this idea that they're issuing the tickets from a traffic safety standpoint, well, you would think that you'd want to issue those tickets in places where more people get killed. That wasn't what we found. When we did the analysis, we found that the number of tickets does not correlate strongly with where people are getting killed. And there was a graphic that did a really good job explaining this, where you looked at majority Black census tracts. Census tracts are the most accurate way we have to look at the population of the city. And you would see that tickets go up exponentially if you're in a majority Black census tract, even though the deaths do not.
Sharif on the north side. Sharif, good morning. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. Right. First time I heard this mentioned, but it is an injustice to the African-American community because the police authority does not write tickets during the games, Florida-Georgia game, you know, and they walk, jaywalk, and all of that. They walk with open containers. Nobody writes tickets. So it's an injustice.
Sharif, thanks for the call. That's an interesting example he brought up. When you have a big event, say like the Florida-Georgia game, that's a different dynamic than just people in an everyday, going about their business every day in a neighborhood. But what about his observation?
Well, I mean, it's long been a thing for those who've been here in Jacksonville forever. It's long been a thing. You don't go downtown doing Florida-Georgia game. And it's a legalized jaywalking. It's all legalized. Everybody knows that. You can walk wherever you want to walk, carry a container, and it's all been sanctioned by the city in the interest of making money and our guests and all that. The issue here, however, is again, going back to simple indignities on giving somebody a ticket that costs. Do you know how long it takes to earn $65 in those zip codes where they're getting this kind of thing? And you can drive down Arlington Expressway any day of the week, probably right now, and you'll find somebody skirting over the fence over both lanes to get to the other side of Arlington Expressway, and I've never seen anybody get a ticket.
Mm-hmm. All right, one more call. Go ahead, Ben.
We have found tickets in Arlington Expressway, but I think it's an interesting point in itself in that Arlington Expressway, right? And this really goes back to the historical aspect of all this. These expressways were kind of carving through these neighborhoods, and when we did this as a city, we built these big roads. We did not give people enough places to cross, and then when they started crossing, we built a fence, and now they're jumping over the fence. And I understand that some of these engineering solutions can be kind of expensive. But, you know, the sheriff's office will say, you know, if we give out this many tickets and we save one life, then it's worth it. And I have to ask if the city leadership feels that way about infrastructure. If you can spend a couple $100,000 on a crossing and save some lives so that people don't have to walk 2 miles to get across the expressway, they're not going to. People don't want to run across a four-lane highway and jump over a fence in the middle. Well, no one wants to do that.
Yeah.
Well, Ben, they're doing it because it's... Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Ben. That's one of the reasons why the overpass was built at 45th and Moncrief Road going to St. Clair Evans School because of the number of kids who were getting killed at that intersection. And we find that in different places. And this is... And that of course, when we talk about crossing main thoroughfares, is one of the things the city itself had to look at. It is not something the sheriff's office would look at other than to report the statistics. And that's sort of the dynamic we have here. We have an issue of engineering versus why are you giving out all these tickets, and is it solving the problem? And the answer seems
and
to
before,
come up as no.
Before we move on to other stories, Ben Konark, what has been the latest response to you from JSO?
Sure. So we communicated very recently with the sheriff's spokeswoman, and as I said, it was sort of a disheartening exchange. It was basically a shrug of the shoulders. They talk about how if it's an infraction, they deserve a ticket, right? And we had this experience with them with an elderly woman who was ticketed for stepping around a flooded sidewalk, and their first reaction was, well, this isn't right. And then when they investigated, they said, well, look, they broke the rule. So we made the point, well, look, everyone jaywalks, even your officers do. And they said, well, give us pictures. And we said, okay, well, when the story publishes, we'll give you pictures. So the story published, and they basically have shrugged their shoulders at that too. So there's this hypocrisy there that is pretty hard, I think, for a lot of people to reckon with, that this agency can tell you with a straight face that, you know, if you break this law, you're going to get a ticket. Meanwhile, their own cops are jaywalking, and we don't think that their cops should get tickets, but we're just pointing out that there's a base level of hypocrisy here that has continued to go unaddressed. So okay. The sheriff talks about wanting to bring the community together, and he seems unwilling to comment on these issues that are very real for people. We would have maybe expected that he wanted to hold a forum and address the issue or get people together and discuss it. And I've seen no indication from the sheriff or anyone around him that that is what they plan to do about this. It seems like they're waiting for it to go away.
Well, we'll continue to follow it, but we do need to move on and talk about some other headlines from the week. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, the number to join the show as we talk about some other stories that caught our eye this week, the number 549-2937. And this was an international story that happened here in Jacksonville this week. 69-year-old Bernardino Bellatite is under arrest after police say the Arlington man plotted to carry out a mass shooting at the local Islamic Center of Northeast Florida. Bellatite told an undercover police officer he wanted to buy a silencer and then told him he planned to shoot up the center during Friday evening services. JSO coordinated with FBI and the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, and they nabbed this guy before he could carry out his deadly attack. So as we hold police's feet to the fire on this investigation about the tickets, at the same time, we do want to note that police acted swiftly and well to foil this terrorist plot against local Muslims.
Maybe he was jaywalking.
Tim Gibbons.
I actually find it interesting that this has been written about, and it was a good job by law enforcement in finding this person. But I find the reaction somewhat muted locally.
Because nothing happened.
It could be that, but it's interesting that somebody was planning something that we often see horrific attacks that involve Muslim perpetrators, and they just seem to get much more of a... much more discussion than they plan to shoot up a mosque.
This guy was secretly recorded by an undercover officer, Fred, saying he hated Muslims and he was going to kill them all. He was heavily armed. He faces multiple charges. So it could have been a very deadly tragedy at the Islamic Center over along 9A if this had occurred.
That is exactly it. And the other thing that strikes me is, and I'm not a profiler, but he doesn't seem to fit the profile of what we would expect to have happen. There have been some minor attacks on the Islamic Center in the past. This truly could have been one of the more horrific. Given, I think this gentleman is of Philippine origin, has mm-hmm. relatives in the Philippines, where there is and has been an ongoing battle with the Islamic citizens there. He just doesn't seem to fit the profile that we would all expect here. There's no question about the evidence that we've been allowed to see concerning this that something major was prevented here from happening with this gentleman, especially the discussion about the purchasing of the silencer and you know, don't say anything about this after we finish the phone call, essentially. So it's a good hit that shows the cooperation, of course, between the FDLE, local sheriff's department. And, you know, it's something that prevented a major catastrophe.
And Ben Konark, a local professor who used to attend that mosque, Parvez Ahmed, told this program they were all extremely grateful for the quick action by law enforcement. And at the same time, they see the big picture is that hate crimes and hate groups are on the rise not just targeted against Muslims, but also Jews and other groups in this country. So this is in the context of that also happening around the nation.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I would say even just as a blanket statement, because I think it gets glossed sometimes. I do report pretty aggressively on the sheriff's office, and I find myself needing to repeat that most cops are very good, hardworking people with a very dangerous job. Even the ones who hand out jaywalking tickets, they think they're doing this for the right reason. This is an example of police work at its best. I mean, it was a good tip from a citizen. It was a good investigation. They prevented what could have been an awful tragedy. I think that the backdrop to this, to me, what I thought of was it was about a week after our president made some pretty inflammatory retweets that were very anti-Muslim. And, you know, as someone of a Jewish background, I feel very personally about this because I come from a religious minority and I understand the challenges that are associated with that. So I feel very deeply for my Muslim brothers and sisters who are living in this highly charged anti-Muslim environment that we kind of live in as a country now. And it's it is saddening to me that we live in an environment that these kinds of mass shootings are very plausible. So I'm also eternally grateful to the men and women of JSO for foiling this plot. And I'm very disturbed that it was this close to happening.
If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week. Lots of news to discuss. We want your calls at 549-2937. And we also need to touch on a tragic end to the political career of former Congresswoman Corrine Brown. This week, Brown was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison. Earlier, she had been convicted on 18 of 22 counts of tax, wire, and mail fraud stemming from her involvement in a bogus charity, One Door for Education. Brown's attorney, though, says she will file an appeal. Her former chief of staff, Ronnie Simmons, and One Door's founder, Carla Wiley, were given slightly lighter sentences. And this is sort of the coda to this really tragic story as Corrine Brown, who carried such heavy political weight in this area for so many years, must now report to federal prison in January.
I think this surprised a lot of people that this is a fairly weighty sentence. I think there was an expectation that considering her age, considering whatever you think of the Congresswoman, she obviously had years of public service to the area, that there was a certain amount of not leniency, but not years and years in federal prison. I don't think that was widely expected.
Yeah. Fred Matthews, Judge Tim Corrigan said that he felt the sentence was fair. Many prominent people in the community appealed to him for leniency in Ms. Brown's case.
Well, I think the sentence was as fair as he could make it, given the fact that when you look at other congresspersons around the country who've gotten in trouble and who've been in for far more serious, I consider far more serious issues than this, have all received prison sentences and have had to serve all of part of it. It looks as if she may only have to serve, 2-3 years, given the guidelines and the fact she has not been convicted of anything before. But, you know, again, this is one of those media stories. I don't know what the media, particularly the television stations, are going to do now that they no longer have anybody to chase.
I'll have to find new stories.
You won't have Corrine Brown to kick around anymore?
Yeah, I mean, all my years of covering the federal courthouse and the old courthouse with this, I mean, this was quite a circus to behold. And of course, certainly one of those bigger than life figures that that Jacksonville has. I just don't know what they're going to do with this, but hopefully, you know, this will give some rest to that over the holidays. Certainly, she's going to do the standard appeals.
She'll appeal, of course.
But this, as you said, is a coda to a long journey for her and the persons involved. And it'll be interesting as we look forward now to her current congressional successor is going to remain in the chair.
That's right. We'll have to see about that. That's Al Lawson. And Ben Konark, as Fred pointed out, Corrine Brown was one of the first African-American members sent to Congress in this state since Reconstruction. And, of course, she had been a polarizing figure for many years, not least of which involving the gerrymandering fight over congressional and legislative districts in Florida, which she fought. We also need to point out that it was your colleagues at the Times Union that exposed the sham charity, One Door for Education.
Yeah, the work that Nate Monroe, Chris Fong, and Steve Patterson did on this was really astounding, and some of the paper's best work in the last decade. So it's been, for me, it's been interesting to, Nate and I are buddies, we've spoke a lot about this case, and it was great reporting. I kind of see a parallel here with the sexual harassment scandal, which is, a lot of the times it gets kind of chopped up along partisan lines. And I feel like this is a good example of corruption is corruption and will be prosecuted no matter what party you're affiliated with. So this investigation was started under the Obama administration by the Department of Justice. It's worth noting that, it was the DOJ was apolitical in its pursuit of Corrine Brown. So in an era when we're hearing a lot about, people undercutting the, federal law enforcement, I think it's kind of a lesson that, it doesn't really matter what party you affiliate with. If you are corrupt, you will be brought to justice.
Let's go to Stephanie now in Atlantic Beach. Hey, Stephanie, good morning. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. The comment was made that this was such a heavy sentence for Corrine Brown. I myself am outraged by that view. She was found guilty on 18 counts. There's been no remorse. She has not once said, oh, yes, this was a terrible thing I did. This won't happen again. And yet she's still walking around free. I'm sorry. She didn't even get the minimum sentence of 7 years. She was given such a light sentence and a slap on the wrist, and she's still walking around. I'm sorry, gentlemen. You have got the... This is outrageous, what she has done. In fact, people are usually tried on separate counts, and they serve multiple sentences. She was always given one package. Oh, these 18 counts will go under one sentencing. How outrageous is this?
All right. Thanks, Stephanie. Gotcha.
$100 a year? Excuse me?
Yeah.
That's never going to repay the money that she has filtered and spent lavishly.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Outrageous.
Yes. And so that call shows that for there were many ardent defenders of Corrine Brown. There are many ardent critics of Corrine Brown. Always a polarizing figure in our political sphere right to the end.
And we'll probably continue to be. Just to be clear, the statement I made was not that this was a heavy sentence, but that it was heavier than people necessarily expected. There was plenty of commentators and those looking at it who assumed that she would not actually spend time in prison. So
yeah.
I don't believe, just to correct the call, I'm not sure if there actually was a mandatory minimum for that one.
I'm not sure, but you could hear the anger in Stephanie's voice.
Yeah.
That shows you that there's a lot of anger at bad behavior by our elected officials, both Democrat and Republican.
And there's been a view that Corrine got away with stuff for years, and that this is, this is what they caught her on, but that there was other bad behavior.
At the same time, particularly, and you tell me, Fred, but when I talk to some African-Americans who supported Corrine Brown all along, they will say, well, there are plenty of white folks who are doing things who haven't been brought to justice. And Corrine Brown did do a lot of good in this community, too. So they really saw the prosecution of her as she, in her own words, a witch hunt.
Well, I mean, that's how many people will see it. I mean, again, it's, as you say, historically, this is a person that you knew. Okay, this is Corrine Brown, goes all the way back to Stanton High School, majorette, graduated with all of us, went to FAMU. You could walk into Walgreens and see her shopping, not just for herself, but for folks in the housing complex and that sort of thing. So it wasn't somebody that was untouchable. And I think that's why many in her constituent community will view this as being different. That being said, the judge made the decision on what the sentence would be. Mm-hmm. The judge looked at the issue and all the statements that had been made, and the judge decided that this would be what he would proclaim for her to serve. Mm-hmm. And that's what it came down to. It wasn't a question of whether Corrine wanted it. It's a question of whether Judge Corrigan was going to give the sentence.
Well, finally, it is our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there's never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And speaking of public officials behaving badly, guys, only in Florida does the mayor of a small town use the handicap parking tag of dead people to park at City Hall. Yes, Davenport Mayor Teresa Bradley arrested this week after deputies videotaped her parking in the handicap spot in front of City Hall there. A search of her home found two handicap parking permits of people who had died.
Did she kill them to steal their handicap?
Davenport is a small town, so frankly, only in Florida thinks it odd. She didn't think anyone might notice this. The video shows an open legal parking spot next to the disabled ones. Deputies say they spotted her parking in the special spots, placing the placard on her mirror before leaving her car, and then removing the placard again once she returned. Ben Konark, maybe you could do an investigation into people using handicap spots.
Please don't.
Using handicap placards illegally. I bet this goes on more often than we realize.
Ignore that, Ben. Don't do
it. I'll put it in the hopper.
And only in Florida is it revealed that the person behind Uber's massive 2016 data breach is a 20-year-old man from Florida. Florida man, you might say. Uber says the hack affected nearly 60 million customers worldwide. It turns out the guy responsible is a man living in Florida with his mom in a small home and trying to pay the bills. We don't know his identity, but he was able to compromise a hefty amount of personal data out of Uber, including our names, email addresses, and phone numbers. No idea who he is, but Florida man strikes again.
If he got a lot of data, the surge pricing would kick in.
Thanks to our panel, Tim Gibbons, Ben Konark, and Fred Matthews. Guys, thanks for joining us.
Have a great weekend.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you, and we'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Hey there, it's Joshua Johnson with a quick question. Are you a good listener? I guess you say you are, but why is it that at a time when we can consume more news and listen to more radio than ever, many of us have just stopped listening to each other? Every day on 1A, we'll champion your right to speak freely, and we know you're ready to talk. So join me, Joshua Johnson, next time on 1A from WAMU and NPR. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, every year there are a group of volunteers who do their part to make the holidays a little brighter for underprivileged students and families in Jacksonville. Bright Holidays gets going every year at this time, and they work with local schools to deliver clothing, food, school supplies, and more to the kids who need it most. They've brought the joy of the season to hundreds of local children, and this year they hope to reach even more with your help. Mike Shreve heads up Bright Holidays. Good morning.
Good morning.
And this is such a great effort because it's entirely volunteer. There's no overhead. So if you donate to Bright Holidays, you know, Mike, that 100% of what you're giving is going to go to local kids and families.
Exactly
right.
Yeah. Yep.
So what do you need this year?
Well, as always, our main needs are volunteers.
and generous donations. Our donations come from organizations, but mostly from individuals. And our volunteers, we have over 150. What we do is we work with the schools, and they identify the poorest families, and then they gather, the schools work with the parent to gather their shoe size and pant size, et cetera. And then we go about shopping shirt, pants, underwear, jacket, shoes, socks, a book, a sleeping bag, because sometimes they don't have a bed, a toy, and also a gift card to Winn-Dixie, who is a kind partner and gives us a nice deal.
Very nice.
So what we need volunteers to make all that happen, and then we need donations to make it happen. We serve about 800 kids for the last – we've been in business for 12 years. We've served about 800 kids every year for about the last 6 years.
And you'd like to get it even more this year, break 1,000.
We would love to. We'd love to, yeah. And so and most of our project is already underway. We have a big day tomorrow with volunteers pulling a lot of it together. And in fact, we're already kind of filled up with volunteers for tomorrow. If you want to volunteer, it's more like a next year thing. Go to brightholidays.org. But donations would absolutely allow us to raise the number of kids. We're at about 760 now. We'd love to get, I'm sure we'll get over 800. If we had more donations, we could keep going.
So can people bring items to donate at your event tomorrow? What can they do to help?
Actually, there's our friends at Hobnob over in Unity Plaza are having an event next Sunday from 11 to 2 with Santa Claus, where you can bring a new toy that we can use. And you can also go to brightholidays.org and make a donation, and that will turn into gifts for more kids. And our school partners, they can find more families. All we have to do is ask.
Right. And people might not realize the level of poverty in this community. How many kids are on free or reduced lunch? How many kids don't have food, don't have clothes, don't have toys at Christmas, at the holidays? This is an easy way to make sure that these children, you know, they have a nice something under the tree and that they can try to enjoy the holidays at least a little bit.
And the parents are so excited when they get these gifts because we heard about tears from parents when they find out there's a gift card to Winn-Dixie too, because they knew they were getting gifts for their children, but, you know, a little something to maybe eat a little bit more over Christmas. One of our favorite stories is we asked the teachers, how do you identify which kids are in most in need? Oh, we know. We see them every day. We see the little second graders who cry on Friday afternoons because they know they may not eat again until they come to school.
Yeah.
I don't know if people even realize that these schools serve breakfast and lunch to most of these kids at schools where there's a significant poverty level.
Right. It really can't be stated enough that every little bit helps. Now, as you said, Mike, people need to go to your website, brightholidays.org.
Correct.
They can donate right on the website.
Correct. Is PayPal there?
Or they can volunteer.
That's right.
And for volunteering, that just involves what? There's a sorting day tomorrow. They could be part of that.
Yeah. We already have 150 people coming tomorrow, so we might be good. But, I mean, we have sorting. The bulk of the items have been purchased weeks ago. And it's all new stuff we give, by the way. And we have various volunteer opportunities, maybe four or five we've had already, where people come and help sort through that stuff. Tomorrow we pull it completely together, and there's a hefty bag for each child with all of his 10 items in it. And that takes 150 people to do 800 kids. Right?
Yeah, really. Well, so go to brightholidays.org. It's such an easy way to help children in this community at the holidays. Make the holidays a little brighter for these kids. And Mike Shreve, always great to see you. Hope you are bigger and better than ever this year. Thank you so much for all you do for this community.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you. Again, that's brightholidays.org. Go to the website, donate, sign up to volunteer, and be part of this effort. We're going to take a quick break in a moment, a look at a special holiday celebration on Lomax Street in Five Points. That's coming up tomorrow morning. And also, how you can enjoy some classic Shakespeare this holiday season right here in our WJCT studios. We'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Ira Flatto. On the next Science Friday, it's our annual Best Science Books of the Year show, including the women who were the unsung heroes of the American code-breaking work during World War II. Books for kids, also. Plus, a look at coastal restoration efforts in Louisiana, from mangrove seed bombs to fighting off an invasion of the mealybug. It's all on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, come on out for the first annual Christmas on Lomax party. It's on Lomax Street in historic Five Points with special guests Anna and Elsa, members of the Roar of the Jaguars, even a visit from Santa himself. This has been put together by some of the merchants and store owners in the area. We're speaking to three of them now. Troy Sperlin of Generation Us, a relatively new store in Five Points.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. Gwen Minter from Gloss Goods is here.
Thanks for having us.
And Marianne Rodriguez of Root Realty.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so there are Christmas special events like this all over town, but this is a new one for Five Points. Tell me about Christmas on Lomax.
Well, we're really excited to bring something new to the Five Points area. We've been known in the neighborhood to have a lot of great block parties and street events, but not a lot that appealed to a younger generation. So we wanted to have something fun in the morning, right around the holiday season, where we could bring a little bit of Christmas cheer to our little shopping district.
What's going to be happening?
Oh my gosh, we've got everything. We've got Santa Claus, we've got the Jacksonville Roar, we've got story time with Elsa, we have ornament making, we have Christmas cookie decorating, we have treats, we have a football toss. We've got all sorts of things going on. I think also a curling station for the young girls to get primped for Santa or for pictures with the Roar.
Very nice. And this is definitely something people want to bring their kids to. This is sounds like a really family-friendly good time in Five Points.
Absolutely. As Gwen mentioned, you know, there is a lot to do for the millennials in the area, the older generation, and we just wanted to really combine and collaborate for a really family-oriented event, and what better place to do it than outside of our businesses.
And there are so many great businesses in this part of town, and stores have come and gone over the years, but you guys have two new businesses that are making a splash in Five Points. Let's talk about those for a minute, Gloss and Generation Us.
Well, Gloss Goods, I think, was one of the first newer retail spaces on Lomax. I followed shortly, and right behind us was Marianne with Root Realty. So we're all three neighbors and very excited to bring new energy and new life to Lomax, which is adjacent to Park Street at the blinking light.
You know, it's a lot of fun. We all know about Park Street. You know where the theater is. You know where the restaurants are. There's lines outside Hawkers. But Lomax is this really precious little corridor right next to it that has amazing retail spaces that had been vacant for a little while. So it's fun to be bringing in some new types of businesses to the area. Gloss Goods has cosmetics, a lot of natural beauty, gorgeous jewelry and gifts. So a wonderful place to be this time of year. And then Troy's store is absolutely fantastic with all the home furnishings and things like that.
I think one thing that's really cool, so we are Root Realty and we are above Owens Pharmacy, definitely an established business in the area. So it's been really fun to...
very established business.
Yes.
How long has that place been there? My gosh.
42, maybe?
Yeah.
So it's been fun to bring some new energy to the area. And I think what's really cool is right now I'm wearing a necklace from Gloss Goods and our couch in our office is from Generation Us. So we really are a very supportive culture in the neighborhood. And I'm so stoked to be on board for this event.
Is the visit from Santa... could it possibly be Troy Sperlin who we're going to see under that Santa hat?
I think his name is Bob. So.
Oh, so you're not playing Santa.
I am not playing Santa.
We have
Santa.
A real Santa.
You'd make a great Santa, though. You really would. Well, it sounds like a great time. And people need to come out. This is coming up. The first ever Christmas on Lomax party on Lomax Street in historic Five Points, kicking off December 9th at 9 a.m. from 9 a.m. to noon. Come on out and bring the kids, because this is definitely some fun family holiday cheer happening. Thanks so much for being here, Troy, Gwen, and Marianne. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And finally this hour, one more note, WJCT will be the stage for Classic Shakespeare this holiday season as Phase 8 Theater Company presents Love's Labor's Lost right here in our studios. Stars Evie Day and Corey Driscoll join us now. Good morning, my thespians.
Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
All right, so it's so exciting that WJCT is presenting this Phase 8 production, not this weekend, but next weekend. Evie, you play Boyette in the show?
I do.
And tell us about her really quickly.
She's the messenger and sort of business manager for the four women from France who come and meet up with the four men. And I sort of facilitate the encounters.
The encounters. This is a romantic comedy as the king and his buddies decide we're not going to spend any time with women. We're going to just be celibate. But then a bunch of women show up
exactly.
And things start happening. Is that right, Corey?
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
We're very excited to present a small excerpt from Love's Labor's Lost, courtesy of Phase 8 Theater Company. All right, what are you going to be performing?
This is a brief monologue that my character has where she's trying to convince the women that the men have fallen for the princess.
And here we are.
Why all his behaviors did... Why all his behaviors did make their retire to the court of his eye, peeping thorough desire. His heart, like an agate, with your print impressed. Proud in his form, in his eye, pride expressed. Awe, his tongue, all impatient to speak and not see, did stumble with haste in his eyesight to be. All senses to that sense did make their repair, to feel, only looking on fairest of fair. Methought all his senses were locked in his eye, like jewels and crystal for some prince to buy, who, tendering their own worth from where they were glassed, did point you to buy them along as they passed. His face's own margin did quote such amazes that all eyes saw his eyes enchanted with gazes. I'll give you Aquitaine and all that is his, if you give him for my sake but one loving kiss.
Love's Labor's Lost. Beautiful. I can't wait to see this. Shakespeare at the holidays. What could be bad about that? Right,
absolutely.
Guys? That's very right. Exciting. So you need to get your tickets now. Phase8.org as Phase 8 Theater Company presents Shakespeare here in our WJCT studios on December 14th, 15th, and 16th. Again, that website, phase8.org for tickets. Evie Day, Corey Driscoll, break a leg. We're excited that you'll be performing in our studios. Have fun with it.
Thank you, Melissa.
All right, and that is our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. We'll rebroadcast this show tonight at 8, and don't forget to tune in at 1 o'clock this afternoon for our new statewide program, the Florida Roundup. 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be back Monday at 9 a.m. See you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.